Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Moving to the winter wheat crop, heading progress nationally for winter wheat, reaching the three-quarters mark on May 25th. That's ahead of the five-year average of 70%, but slightly behind last year's 76%.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA looking at the latest winter wheat crop heading conditions.
We now see at least some heading progress in all 18 major producing states. Lowest on the list is Montana at 1%. That is equal to the five-year average. Next on the list, South Dakota at 3% headed. Five-year average there is 9%. As you move to the south, though, progress is much quicker, driving that national number above average. In top producer Kansas, nearly all the crop, 93%, has headed. That's ahead of the five-year average of 87%.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm happy to report that we've made substantial progress between the United States and China in the very important trade talks.
3 weeks ago, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Switzerland.
First, I want to thank our Swiss host. The Swiss government has been very kind in providing us this wonderful venue, and I think that led to a great deal of the productivity we've seen. We will be giving details tomorrow, but I can tell you that the talks were productive. We had the vice premier, two vice ministers who were integrally involved, Ambassador Jameson and myself, and I spoke to President Trump, as did Ambassador Jameson last night, and he is fully informed of what is going on.
Originally, Bessent said,
throughout the trade process, we have had a plan, we have a process in place, and now with the Chinese, after this weekend, we have a mechanism for continued talks. So, process, plan, and mechanism. I would say one of the big takeaways from this weekend, the United States will continue a strategic rebalancing in many areas that were exposed as supply chain weaknesses during COVID, whether it's medicines, whether it's semiconductors, steel, the other. We've identified five or six strategic industries and supply chain vulnerabilities, and we will continue moving toward U.S. independence or reliable supplies from allies on those. But the consensus from both delegations this weekend is neither side wants a decoupling. And what had occurred with these very high tariffs, as Ambassador Greer said, was the equivalent of an embargo, and neither side wants that. We do want trade. We want more balanced trade, and I think that both sides are committed to achieving that. We would like to see China open to more U.S. goods. We expect that as the negotiations proceed, that there will also be a possibility of purchase agreements to pull what is our largest bilateral trade deficit into balance. That has gotten out of balance, and much of this has happened through neglect over the past 4 years, as the previous administration did not engage on this issue. That was put forward to us by the Chinese, in fact, and we can see it in what happened to the Phase One agreement. We are only looking forward, and we look forward to very good discussions now that we have the mechanism created in Geneva this weekend for talks.
But trade talks, he says, today are a bit stalled, less than 3 weeks after the temporary truce. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Kind of a reminder is rabies is a virus.
Greg Hanselchek is a Kansas State veterinarian.
It's a little unique as a virus in that once an animal or a human becomes infected, this virus actually travels through the nerves, to the spinal cord, and then through the spinal cord to the brain. And it causes a brain infection is what it is. And it is 100% fatal in both humans and animals. There's been a couple humans that have survived, but they aren't normal because of the damage it does to the brain. So that's number one. It's a virus, 100% fatal. Lots of species can be, just about any species can become rabid. In Kansas, the carrier species is the skunk, but the most common wild species that we see in Kansas are bats and skunks both.
He talks about geographical variants.
In the Midwest, in Kansas in particular, we have the skunk variant. And so the skunk's a carrier. They rarely come down with the infection. They just spread it to other species. And then other species, we call those dead-end hosts, meaning once they become infected that they die. But we've got the skunk variant here. On the East Coast, they've got a tremendous problem with rabies. It's the raccoon variant. And then down in the southwest part of the United States and in Alaska, there's a fox variant. We're a little unusual in the diagnostic lab here when we test animals for rabies. And the only test for rabies is actually brain tissue. So there is no pre-life test. It's an afterlife test. But any positive rabid brain that we test, we're going to gene sequence that to make sure that it is the skunk variant, because we're conscious about the fact we don't want to bring in a raccoon variant or a fox variant. So we're a little bit unique in what we do, that extra test on every positive sample.
And then there are the carriers of the virus.
Again, it's skunks, bats, horses, sheep, goats, foxes. We've had a couple of positive foxes in Kansas over the years. As far as bovine, we've actually had 17 positive cases in Kansas over the last 9 years. And in some of those years, the cattle were the most common domestic species that were clinical with rabies. Most years and most Midwest states, it's the cat. Felines are the most common clinical rabies, but in Kansas, a lot of times it is bovine.
And says it's important to know how rabies is spread.
They have to be bitten, basically, is what it is. And we presume that it's probably a skunk. You know, the cattle are curious. There's a rabid skunk. And so they're out there sniffing and smelling and whatever. And then they get bit or, you know, it's hard to say. But it can only be spread through the saliva or through nervous tissue is basically the way that it's spread. So there has to be some type of bite in order for cattle to become rabid. The other weird thing about rabies is that the incubation period, or the period from when infection occurs to when clinical signs occur, depends on what part of the body the infection occurs. So let's say a cow's bitten on the back leg. Because this virus is going to travel up the nerves in the leg to the spinal cord and then to the brain, it's going to take a while for that animal to show clinical signs versus, let's say, a heifer was out there sniffing at a rabid skunk and it got bit on the muzzle. It's a shorter distance from the muzzle through the nerve tissue to the brain, and so it's going to become clinical faster.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of the big safety nets for producers has been crop insurance.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Plains Cotton Growers.
Crop insurance has been very helpful from the standpoint of the last three seasons, whenever we have seen those below average rainfall years, and we've had a lot of crop failures out here. And so the insurance is very important. Also, of course, we have the farm bill, but as we know, the farm bill did not get passed again last year. And there were some very helpful items that were in the House Ag Committee version of the farm bill that got passed on a bipartisan vote within that committee. But then toward the end of the year. We still had not seen the farm bill come through on the Senate side, and unfortunately, it just died in the legislative process last year. But we do have good news. We saw the what many refer to as the One Big Beautiful Bill, the reconciliation package that was passed, barely passed, I would say, by the House last week. But that's all that matters. It was passed. And so now that bill moves forward to the Senate. And there are actually many things in that bill that will be of great help to agriculture. And probably one of the most outstanding things would be that if it passes as it's gone through the House, there is the opportunity to raise reference prices to make them more realistic to today's input prices and the margins that we're dealing with. And so if we do see that pass, then that would be effective as of this 2025 growing season. And so that's something that we're certainly hoping for, and we're going to be watching on the Senate side and seeing how that legislation progresses.
Now, that helps us today, but what about down the road, navigating farm succession? Jessica Grosskopf with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
I think it's common in farming and ranching culture for us to measure success by how many generations have been in the operation. Often, when farmers and ranchers introduce themselves, they say, I'm the fifth or sixth generation, in this business. And when we don't have someone coming back into the operation, I think it's difficult to grapple with the fact that you might be the last generation to farm or to ranch. And so this idea of ambiguous loss really resonates because for a lot of families, they have to grieve the loss of that type of legacy. And so that's why ambiguous loss really resonated with me when I first heard about the concept, is I see a lot of producers in this situation who need to deal with the emotions of not having someone come back. And I think the best way to describe it is as ambiguous loss, where there is no closure, and it's difficult for others to recognize that they are grieving the fact that they don't have that next generation to carry on this business.
She talks about succession plans in ag.
We believe that between 50 and 60% of farm and ranch families do not have a solid succession plan in place. And so, again, that's a little bit different than an estate plan. A succession plan says that we've identified that heir and we're actually passing the business to someone else, where an estate plan is simply those end of life documents. So when it comes to that succession side, there's a very high percentage that have not identified who that heir, related or not related, will be.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Thanks to the Swiss government and Swiss officials for hosting us this weekend. The atmosphere was very conducive to discussions, and thanks to them, we were able to have very constructive and positive conversations with our Chinese counterparts, who clearly came to deal this week.
U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer, back 3 weeks ago, announcing progress in trade deals with China. They are now, though, stalled.
The rapid nature that we were able to conduct and conclude these discussions is a testament to mutual understanding and mutual respect between the Chinese and U.S. sides. With respect to the U.S. Trade position, our interactions with China, and the agreement today, please keep in mind that the United States trade deficit has ballooned over the past several years, ending up at $1.2 trillion deficit in goods as of the end of last year, which was an approximately 42% increase over a few years prior, when there was an $850 billion trade deficit at the beginning of the Biden administration. So that is a rapid and expansive increase in the trade deficit, and our view is that this is driven in large part by non-reciprocal trade, among other things, and the result has been offshoring of manufacturing and other negative impacts on the U.S. economy. And so on January 20th, when the president was inaugurated, he released the America First trade policy, which was comprehensive, and flagged that he, and actually directed agencies, including U.S. Trade Representative and others, to research this issue and to provide options, which we did, and the president elected to impose reciprocal tariffs on April 2 to address this national emergency of the trade deficit, There was a global baseline tariff accompanied by higher reciprocal tariffs for each country depending on the level and intensity of their trade surplus with the United States. In all of this, China was assigned a reciprocal tariff rate of 34%. China was the only country that chose to implement retaliation against the United States for this reciprocal tariff. All other countries withheld and decided that they wanted to negotiate with the United States or simply not retaliate. And so we've been in detailed discussions with other countries for several weeks at this point. China, as you know, retaliated not only with tariffs, but with disproportionate and asymmetrical non-tariff measures in order to maintain the effectiveness of the reciprocal tariff measures. The president increased our tariff rates to offset Chinese retaliation. And as you know, this escalated to a point where both sides had added 125% tariffs, and with the Chinese side, additional non-tariff measures amounting to an embargo in some senses on trade, an effective embargo, which of course was not a sustainable practice for either side. And so today, with this agreement, we come to agreement that that our reciprocal tariff rate will go down to 10% on the United States side, so it goes down 115%. We enter into a 90-day pause period for negotiations, which both the Chinese and the United States are very committed to, and the Chinese on their side also go down 115%. To 10%, and they remove the countermeasures that they have in place. To be very clear, other measures that the United States has put in place in the past, whether it's tariff measures from 2018 or since, tariffs under other statutory authorities, tariffs related to fentanyl, those remain unchanged for now to the side. I'll just make one point, is that both the Chinese and the United States agreed to work constructively together on fentanyl, and there's a positive path forward there as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Rodeo is not new. It's been around, national finals, PRCA and all that, and a very high-end sport that are basically professional athletes.
Lehman Wall is manager of the Working Ranch Cowboys Association on differences between their rodeos and professional ones.
That's the difference that we see in what WRCA is about. We have events that are more catered to the ranching environment day to day. The people that compete with us are not professional athletes. They are real working ranch cowboys that get up every day and help feed the world through raising cattle. And whenever you come to Amarillo and you come to the World Championship, we put an environment together that's really kind of focused on what the ranching community is all about. Family, faith, and really taking care of your business the right way. So we're going to compete in five events, and those events have some semblance of what might happen on the ranch every day in doctoring cattle or penning or moving cattle from place to place. Maybe getting on a ranch bronc every once in a while, a little surly in the morning, and might try you out. So we're going to buck some broncs at our event as well. And then I tell you the one thing that our guys would say, we don't do this on the ranch, so would you please stop making us doing it at the competition? But it's called wild cow milking. So everybody needs the NASCAR, accident to occur, right? You're looking for that wild moment. And that's one of those real fan friendly activities. It may not be real cowboy friendly, if you get my drift. But that's what we're about, is every year in November, we're going to convene in Amarillo, Texas, and bring in, about 30,000 of our closest friends and put on this great activity here. We always say it's not just a rodeo. There's more to this thing. If you guys have never been or have never been able to be a part of this event, we have over 100,000 square feet of vendor shopping space. So this is real cowboy gear. It's oriented around that lifestyle. And you come here and you shop. We have something for the entire family. There's things that happen for the kids. Even the ladies come and shop. There's a lot of boutiques, a lot of jewelry, handmade jewelry, furniture. If you can dream it, we have it available. And it usually stems directly from a ranch maker, or cowboy maker themselves. And that whole environment is what makes this special. It's really a reunion of sorts for the ranching community.
With the championship in November, who qualifies and how?
It all stems from a local community or somebody that has an interest in being a part of WRCA. They will raise their hand and say, hey, we would like to host a sanctioned rodeo. And so we work with those people to really pinpoint parts around the country that make sense. Obviously, Texas and Oklahoma, you know, the ranching communities, Kansas, Nebraska, Wyoming, Colorado, Arizona. You'll dip your toe sometimes over into Wyoming and some of those areas. But you first, in order to have a ranch rodeo, you have to have a ranch, right? There has to be. So back to the real work and ranch cowboy deal. The ranches that compete with us, they have to meet cattle requirements. They have to run so many head to be eligible. And then you can compete for that ranch as an owner, as a full-time employee or a day worker of that operation. And that's what makes it kind of be real ranching oriented.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In the United States, we know that oftentimes Texas will produce around a third to even more of that total amount of U.S. production. And then of the Texas crop, typically we come in at around 50 to 55% of Texas production.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers. It's the center of the largest contiguous growing region in the world.
Yes, a fairly large amount of cotton out here on the high plains of Texas.
He says a controversial report from the White House, the Make America Healthy Again report, could be positive.
You know, it's always important to look at what the underlying causes are for health issues that we have here in this nation. And one of the things that was brought forward in this report and kind of highlighted is something that the cotton industry has been talking about for several years now, and that is the issue of microplastics. And so one of the valuable things about cotton is that we know it's a natural fiber. And being a natural fiber, it breaks down really readily in the environment. And unlike the cotton fibers, we do see a lot of use of polyester fabrics in our wardrobes today. And, you know, there's no doubt that there are certain advantages, for instance, in athletic wear. We see a lot of polyester used, but at the same time, we know that there are many advantages that cotton has over polyester, one of them being the microplastics issue. Both of those products, whenever we wash our clothes in the washing machine, do the family wash, we know that that those materials or those fibers will break off and break down within the rinse water. And those little microfibers move out with the rinse water and then move through our water treatment plants. And then they eventually go out to the lakes and rivers and then to the ocean as well. And we have seen for the last several years a buildup of microplastic fibers in the environment, especially in the waters. And the problem with the microplastics is that they don't break down nearly as readily as cotton, which we see commonly breaks down completely within just a few months. And so that is one big advantage that cotton has over polyester. And again, this MAHA report brought that out and brought out the concern that microplastics are being found within our human bodies. And there's a concern for the environment, for human health, and especially for children. So something that we're going to be continuing to watch and talk about over the coming months.
But looking at cotton nationwide, Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA. Looks at squaring.
Our look for the first time this year at cotton squaring progress shows the national number at 3%, 5-year average 4%, last year at this time 4%, only a couple of states reporting meaningful squaring progress. One is Arizona at 10%, 1 point behind the five-year average. And then Texas, where some of that cotton is planted very early in the South, 4% squaring, five-year average is 7%.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
At this point in the season, last report for May, exactly one half of the crop is rated good to excellent, 19% very poor to poor, just a slight deterioration from last week's 52% good to excellent, 18% very poor to poor, and ironically, very similar to what we saw this time a year ago when the crop was rated 48% good to excellent and 19% very poor to poor.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
As we've been talking all along, are two hot spots, one on the northern plains, one in the far south. The more deterioration this week in Nebraska, which has been missing out on some of that rain that has been benefiting areas further east. 53% of the Nebraska crop now rated very poor or poor. That number has been trending in the wrong direction or higher in recent weeks. Still struggling also in Texas, where the crop's pretty much made, pretty much done. 34% of the crop there rated very poor to poor.